Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the best way to experience a short story? The public radio series Selected Shorts offers listeners a double pleasure, evocative works of fiction read aloud by gifted actors. The idea is to combine great literature and great voices to create a celebration of the short story. It is a formula that has been working for more than 20 years, although host and founder Isaiah Sheffer will say modestly that Symphony Space's efforts were successful even before the organization was good at staging and recording Selected Shorts. Isaiah Sheffer is founder and artistic director of Symphony Space in New York. He's in town for Texas Bound from Broadway, Food Fictions. It is the 18th annual performance in Dallas of Selected Shorts and will begin tonight at 7:30 at the Dallas Theater Center. We are delighted that he's agreed to make time for us this afternoon. Isaiah, welcome to Think.
I'm happy to be here. This is my favorite time of year, my annual Texas trip.
You were actually here for the Super Bowl a couple years ago. Is that right?
No, I don't think I was here for the Super Bowl. Oh, that football game they have
on
the television. Yes,
that TV
right.
game, right.
That's right. That was fun.
So what is the appeal in hearing a story read aloud?
Well, people tell us, people who will come to live performances at Symphony Space in New York or at the other venues where we go on tour, in other cities, or people tell us when they listen on the radio that it reminds them of when their parents read them stories. I think it goes back to something as primal as that, or even around the tribal campfire, people telling tales. It sends people into something of a trance state. We get a lot of letters of people who are driving and have to pull over and listen in their driveway or on the side of the road to a story that is really absorbing them because they're afraid for their driving capabilities. But I think people just like being told a story by a good actor. And we've learned some lessons about what the actor should do and, even more important, what they shouldn't do to try to give a distinctive style to our readings, that they don't sound the same quite as recorded books, which have a function of their own. But this is different. This is a live event in a theater, and you feel when you're a listener on the radio that you're present in the theater. We put up microphones so that you get little nuanced chuckles or sobs or gasps at points in the narrative. And people write in, "I felt like I was there with you at the Texas Theater Center tonight or at Symphony Space when we do them there or in other cities where we travel."
I have to imagine that there are some wonderful pieces of short fiction that do not work for radio.
Oh, absolutely. We've learned that lesson to our pain. In the earliest days of the series, which is now celebrating its 25th year, which dazzles me. I haven't done anything except my marriage for 25 years. There were times when we would do a story because we were amused by it and then afterwards realize, that didn't work well for... And the reason being, the stories that work best read aloud are those that have a clear narrative line, as opposed to, say, a story that is all mood, evocation of mood, even if it's beautifully done, doesn't seem to read as well. Things that are too complicated, whereas on the page you can see who's talking, but a lot of different voices, and it's hard to know when you're being read aloud to just who's talking, who said that, and what's that about. There are technical reasons why some stories, very good stories, don't work out well. But I think we've learned some lessons about how to pick ones that have a strong narrative and that don't have any textual obscurities. And we've done some things, both under the leadership of Kay Catarulo, who invented Selected Shorts.
The Dallas connection of
Selected
Shorts.
That's the Dallas connection. When Kay came to Texas, she invited us to come. And this is the 18th year of coming to Dallas, and we go to San Antonio, we go to Austin, and it's the most fun we have all year. There were some stories that were pretty far out because we were testing the boundaries, but we get a wonderful audience in the live events. William Hurt came off stage after reading the first time he read and said to me in the wings, "Where the hell did you find these people? They listen." And there is sometimes that wondrous silence when you can hear the proverbial pin drop. That is the goal of all performance art, to get that audience to that fine point of total concentration on a moment that's going to happen. It doesn't happen in every single reading, but it happens a lot, and that's where the money is.
Do you have to prepare the audience in some way before you begin the performance?
Well, our regular subscription audience pretty much knows what to expect, that they're going to hear good stories. They don't have to be prepared. What I do, and what our guest hosts do, since at home we have various notable people each year in the literary world come and host a program of stories that they have helped pick, is give some understanding of what's this program about. So that, for example, tonight's program at the Arts and Letters Live is food fictions. So they're all about food or wine or dining. And before each one, I will give a little bit of an intro to set people up to appreciate just what to look for in this story when it comes. For example, Michael Tucker is reading a great story. I wish I was reading it myself. I'm jealous. A story by T.C. Boyle called Sari Fugu, which is an epic battle between the restaurant owner and that woman who's the critic for the newspaper, the food critic. And it's a tour de force. And so people knowing that it's going to be that kind of thing are ready for it. Or I'm reading a story by Roald Dahl, a classic called Taste, which is about a major bet that's placed as to whether a wine connoisseur can guess the exact vineyard and vintage of this particular wine. It's more like a murder mystery than a food story, but it's a great wine story. And Jill Eikenberry is reading a hilarious Dorothy Parker story called Ah, But the One on the Right, about being stuck at a dinner party with a very boring person on her left and a very attractive man on her right whose attention she cannot get. So giving a little bit of intro to what this is about helps the audience to answer your question.
Isaiah Sheffer is here. He is in town for Texas Bound from Broadway Food Fictions. This is a performance that takes place tonight at 7:30 at the Dallas Theater Center. You can find information about that at dallasmuseumofart.org. I want to talk for a minute about this piece, Taste, that you'll be reading tonight by Roald Dahl. I know previously in the series, John Lithgow has performed it.
Yes.
And I'm curious about how different a story is when two different actors read the same exact words.
Well, it's a very good point. It is different. We've had a few stories which in the 25-year history of the series have been read by one actor, perhaps in the West Coast. We go each year to the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles, and we use L.A. actors. And if we want to repeat that story at home in New York, we may get a different actor. And so there is reason to compare. Stories like Raymond Carver's Cathedral have been read by two or three different actors. Each actor brings his or her own sensibility to a piece. Some make it more of a first-person narrative that's very immediate to the person. Some have a greater distance and cool about a first-person tale. I try rehearsing with them to resolve some of these questions, but if an actor really gets into it, he or she is going to bring personal preferences and personal background to it. So they do vary, but within limits. I try in the rehearsal process to have a rehearsal which examines the text and says, now what is this piece and what are we going to make of it and what textual problems there can be, mechanical things like pronunciation problems. I try to define some rules of our series, which one is not to do a lot of voices. For example, in the Taste story, I could do one voice for the host and another voice for this other guy and another voice for the daughter, and that's no good. I think of that as very showy acting. It tells you the actor thinks he can do voices, but it doesn't really help the telling of the story. Mm-hmm. And I advise the actors in rehearsal to do about as much as you would do if you were reading a story to your child. You might make the bad guy have a slightly different voice than the innocent victim, but you wouldn't act a whole voice. We also tell the actors in rehearsal to do something that's the opposite of what they do when they're recording books. When you're doing book recording, and I've done some of it, the emphasis is on exact accuracy and, above all, no dead space, no dead air. Keep it moving. Whereas in the theater, I tell the actors to allow a moment to resonate, even if that means some silence. And it makes for a very different texture. Meryl Streep was reading a story by an Irish writer about teenage kids who invade a woman's home and take it over under the premise that they're there to help her. And there was one moment when the young boy says something, and Meryl, in the theater, silently turned her head to look to the left where this imaginary boy was. There was a silence, and I thought, how will this be on the radio? Silence is no good on the radio. But when I listened to it, she had brought the narrative to the point where the woman and what she might be thinking was just so pulsing with possibility that as she turned to her left, the moment held in radio, you could hear a pin drop across America, I suppose. So I tell actors to allow that to happen, allow a moment to resonate, not to go deliberately too slowly, that's no good either, but just to have fun telling the story.
Do you consider the narrator in a story that is not a first-person story to be a character?
That's one of the key questions of all. You're very sharp. Yes, I do. I can illustrate this by telling you of a rehearsal I had with a wonderful actress and a Texan, by the way, Barbara Barry. She was reading a story by John Cheever at Symphony Space, and we were rehearsing it. And it was a story about suburban adultery. What else is in a Cheever story? And Barbara at one point said, wait a minute, who's talking here? Am I John Cheever? He's male and Protestant. I'm neither. Who's the voice? What voice do you want this to be in, Isaiah? And you have to be quick when actors ask you questions. We were in this rehearsal room, and there were some props around, and there was a little martini glass. I gave it to her and said, hold this glass. You're at a cocktail party in Westchester, and you're dishing the dirt about that couple. And she found it at once. There she was. She had a voice. She was telling about that couple and about their marital troubles.
It changes everything.
So much so that when she later did the reading, a mutual friend came backstage and said, has Barbara got carpal tunnel syndrome or something? She was holding her hand in this funny way because she no longer had the prop martini glass, but that gave her the character. The answer to your question is yes, often a third-person narrator is no more, no less than the author. Then you have to decide, well, what voice does John Updike speak in? And it can be done by a male or a female or a young or an old or a black or a white actor, but you'd take an attitude based on the world of that author and the cultural background and the references of that author. Actors find it easier to do first-person narratives because that's what they're trained to do, become a character, be a person.
Isaiah Sheffer is my guest. He is the host of Selected Shorts on Public Radio. He's in town for Texas Bound from Broadway Food Fictions. That is a series of Selected Shorts readings for the series that will take place tonight at 7:30 at the Dallas Theater Center. You can hear the show Selected Shorts on Saturday evenings at 7 here on KERA. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. And if you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Isaiah Scheffer. He is founder and artistic director of Symphony Space in New York. He is in town for a selected shorts performance, Texas Bound from Broadway, Food Fictions. That'll take place tonight at 7:30 at the Dallas Theater Center. The show itself can be heard on KERA on Saturday evenings at 7. And in case you haven't had a chance to hear it, we will listen to a clip now. This is from a piece that ran a couple of weeks ago, The Chairs by Joshua Ferris, and it's read by Ivy Austin.
Someone passed around a link once to a news article posted on a reputable website that we all read and talked about for days. A man working at an office much like ours had a heart attack at his desk, and for the rest of the day, people passing by his workstation failed to notice. That wasn't the newsworthy bit. There are, 150 million of us in the workplace? It was bound to happen to somebody. What we couldn't wrap our heads around, what made this man's commonplace death national news, was the unlikely information provided in the first sentence of the dispatch. A man working in an Arlington, Virginia insurance firm died of a heart attack at his desk recently, and wasn't discovered until 4 days later when co-workers complained of a bad fruit smell. The article went on to explain that Friday had passed, and then the weekend, and no one...
That was The Chairs by Joshua Ferris, as read by Ivy Austin on Selected Shorts, ran a couple of weeks ago. I believe the podcast may still be available. You can join our conversation this afternoon with Isaiah Scheffer, who is the artistic director and the founder of Symphony Space in New York, which produces Selected Shorts. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Listening to that story, it occurs to me to ask you how you decide which actors to put with which stories.
Well, that's part of the art that we've learned our lessons about gradually. It's like any other theatrical casting. You try to imagine an actor who is, A, available. We work in the nooks and crannies of the more lucrative career opportunities of actors in New York and California and elsewhere. But more than availability, who's right for it, in that they are of the same world or can be imaginatively of the same world as this author. Ivy Austin, who read that piece, is a well-known comedian and singer. She was Garrison Keillor's waitress at the Café Le Boeuf for some years, and she's a regular in our other Symphony Space project, the Thalia Follies Political Cabaret, where right now she's rehearsing for our next Follies next week, singing a song where she's the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, since she's done a few Hillary songs over the past, where James Naughton, our guest star this month, sings to her, "If you ask me, I could tell you how our foreign policy could be conducted now." But Ivy is a working girl and a comic, and she seemed to be the right person for that story.
Do you ever have to talk the actors into the pieces that you've assigned them?
Oh, yes. Yes. Many actors are just trusting. They say, "Send me it, whatever it is, I'm fine." Sometimes a very good actor will call to say, "Now, what is this? What is this story? What's the point? What's the idea here? Who am I?" In other words, they're engaged, but they need to have they don't need to be talked into doing a Selected Shorts appearance. They know that that's always a lot of fun with a good audience that appreciates it. Then it's going to be on the radio and their friends are going to hear them. But they may not immediately grasp what interested us about the story and what the gimmick is or what the angle is that should make it very good. So I do have to work with them. I want to tell you, Chris, about something I'm going to do tonight that is a Dallas premiere, though we've been doing it in New York for some time. We had a consultant a while ago who said, "Oh, Selected Shorts is wonderful. What could be bad? That people have a good experience. They listen to good actors, read good stories. But there's one thing. It's too passive for them. They just sit there listening." I said, "Yeah, that's true. So what do you recommend?" And the consultant said, "You need to do something that is interactive." And we thought of something that was interactive and aerobic. and we inaugurated the post-intermission Selected Shorts sing-along quiz. And the way it will work tonight is that after intermission, I come back out and I tell people first we do a little vocal warm-up. It gets everybody's blood circulating and their diaphragm working well. And then the subject now, since we're approaching Valentine's Day, is, of course, love songs. I sing the first line or two of a well-known or not-so-well-known song from the American Songbook. Then I point to you in the audience, and if you know the answer, you sing out loud and clear, and sometimes we get a very great choral sound, and sometimes we get one feeble voice on the left-hand side of the auditorium who knows that lyric. So it's a test of how much you know pop music and show music and whatever songs I've thought of for the quiz. But tonight, we've never done this in Dallas because we've always performed two shows at the Dallas Museum of Art without intermission, so there can't be a post-intermission anything. But tonight we're, of course, at the Dallas Theater Center, and we will have an intermission. And after the intermission, a chance for you in the audience to sing.
So people have a chance actually to bone up on their romantic songs before they get there tonight.
Yes, I've got some that everybody will know and some that are a little more obscure that only true lovers will know.
Isaiah Scheffer is my guest. He is the host of Selected Shorts and the founder and artistic director of Symphony Space in New York, which produces Selected Shorts. An email from Madeline says, I still remember hearing at the end of the mechanical age, once on your show, it was magic. It led me to read that fabulous book, 60 Stories, by Donald Bartholomew May. I can't thank you and your show enough for all the great leads for a good read.
Well, that's good. It's good that people hear one story and go back to that author and want more. I think the authors will be very pleased at that. I'm very pleased by the mail we get from listeners. It's full of praise, but not praise aside. Praise is nice, but I'm not talking about that. What I'm talking about is the way they describe the ways in which they listen. One woman in Maine wrote to us recently that Selected Shorts has improved her dental hygiene because she flosses for a full hour during the show. We immediately wrote back, too much flossing, you ruin your gums. Not to do that. But seriously, people write that, I am a forest ranger. I'm alone in a tower looking out over a range of the Rockies looking for wisps of smoke, and your stories come to me to keep me company. Prisoners write that 1 hour a week is my 1 hour of culture and humanity. Soldiers write that they're polishing their boots the night before inspection and are listening to the stories. A couple wrote that, we had to give up eating lettuce at dinner because my husband chews lettuce too loudly, and I tell him. And you just picture people around the country enjoying the stories in their own ways. It's very heartwarming. I think it's part of the real hope you can have for America that people are enjoying stories.
Well, you know, it's so funny, Isaiah, because you mentioned that, and I do think people who listen to the show really, you have to fully engage or you miss something.
Yeah.
But it strikes me as odd that we could all be doing this for each other. We could be reading to each other, and we
right.
just don't.
Well, some people do. I mean, I hear from parents who say, we listen to your program, but we also have a regular thing of reading in our house. And they're not necessarily the anti-television homeschoolers, that they're people just like reading. And a lot of people, I was surprised by this, a lot of people belong to book clubs and book clubs that both discuss books, but also clubs in which they read aloud to each other. We invented something, Catherine Minton, the producer of Selected Shorts, invented something called the Thalia Book Club. The Leonard Nimoy Thalia is the smaller theater downstairs at Symphony Space, endowed by the actor Leonard Nimoy. And there we, at the Thalia Book Club, we have authors being interviewed by various literary types and actors reading examples from their books. But the people who come are members of book clubs that do a lot of reading aloud to each other. I think it's spreading.
How often do authors who are still alive and aware that their piece is going to be used have suggestions on how things should be read?
Well, sometimes they do. The late Grace Paley, whom we just honored in a memorial program, who was an original great friend of the series, the first year we were doing it, I called her to say, Grace, can we use your story the loudest voice about the little Jewish girl who's in the school Christmas play. And she said, oh, you want me to come read the loudest voice? I said, no, no, Grace. We're starting a new series where actors read. She said, oh, I make a living on the circuit reading my story. I said, well, would you give us permission, please, Grace? And, well, you're going to get an actor to do it? I said, yes, I've got Linda Lavin, who's a terrific actress, and she'll do it very well. And Grace said, I don't know. Don't let her make it too Jewish. Don't let her make it too filled up with shtick. Keep it simple. So I had rehearsals with Linda, who's a fine actress, and we really perfected the reading of the piece with all due restraint that was necessary. But came the night of the performance, Grace was there, and I was trembling in my shoes. And after the reading, which I thought had gone pretty well, Grace comes trundling backstage in her space shoes, and I'm thinking, well, well, well. And I said, what do you think? She said, well, she read it very different from me, but she read it very well. So I breathed a sigh of relief.
High praise, I guess.
High praise. We've had moments that we call hug'em or slug'em when the author is present in the audience. It happens fairly often because we do a lot of contemporary stuff. And the actor finishes and takes a bow, and then I come out and bring the author up on stage to take a bow with them. And that's the opportunity to hug the actor or slug the actor. And we haven't had too many slugs. A lot of authors have said, it opened up things I didn't know were in the story, having another sensibility express it. Maybe that was just being kind, but I think they really had eyes opened by that.
Because they've only heard it in their own voice.
That's right. That's right.
Isaiah Sheffer is my guest. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to John in Richardson. Hi, John.
Hey, Chris. At the beginning of the show a while ago, you and Isaiah were talking about the fact that some of these stories really are great when you read them, and in hindsight, they turn out not to be quite as successful when they're read. One that's kind of the opposite example is one that was from several years ago. It still is the favorite one I've ever heard on the show, called The Dinner Party. And I laughed so much through the entire thing that through the help of Symphony Space, I was able to get a printed copy of it. And that's when I discovered it didn't work for me when I was reading it the way it did when I heard the marvelous, it was an actress in this time, at this particular case, that was reading it. But it was just so funny.
Well, funny.
A lot of people being introduced, but different words that we're not used to hearing in that context. It was great.
Thanks so much for your call, John.
Thank you.
I'm glad to hear that our system of helping people find printed copies is working. We have a reading list that is available online at selectedshorts.org that tells you everything about Selected Shorts, where we're performing, and our CDs, which are our little cottage industry of the ones that listeners like best, and about a reading list of where you can find the stories.
Has everything that you do been previously published somewhere?
No, not necessarily. The vast bulk of it has been, but we will do stories that come in over the transom from new unpublished writers, and we get a lot of them submitted, and then we have an annual contest, which is also the details of which are on the website. It's called the Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Contest, where you're assigned a topic and you can write a story, and if it's chosen by the judges, it gets broadcast. It gets read in the theater, then broadcast on the radio series, and there's a cash prize. So a lot of writers submit entries into that. So we've done quite a few unpublished stories.
How do you pick the ones that you do yourself? I know that often you probably let pieces go to other actors that you would love to take on.
Oh, yes.
I heard you do a really interesting dialect piece. It may have been recorded some time ago. It was like a Yiddish dialect piece.
Is that the Nice Baby?
Yeah, it's the one, yeah.
Well, that's an old favorite of mine. That's not even a Yiddish dialect. It's a surreal dialect of a Yiddish that never was by this writer, Milt Gross, who wrote, listen, mine children, you're going to hear what it really happened to Paul Revere on the 18th from April in 75. I think what the horse is still alive, according mine racetrack returns this year. That was chosen by the host of that program, Art Spiegelman. And he said, I want to do one of the Milt Gross cartoons. And I said, I've loved those ever since I was a child. So he chose it. The way I choose is when we read stories, the actor instinct within me really quickens when I think, oh, I'd like to do this one. And then our producer, Catherine Minton, allows me one a year, one a year at home at Symphony Space. I'm also the general understudy. So if somebody suddenly is sick at the last moment, sometimes I get to do two a year. And then on tour, I do one when in the places we go. So over the course of the year, I do read quite a few stories. I guess I have no better answer for that question than if it just turns me on, the idea. I love reading certain authors. I love reading T. Karagas and Boyle. Kay Catarulla and I met Tom Boyle years ago when we were first starting the series. I've read many of his stories, his wonderful story, Heart of a Champion, which I've read here in Texas, which is a revisionist version of the Lassie legend. And so for this program tonight, I was very tempted to want to do the Sari Fugu restaurant and critic story because I just like that, and I've never read that story. Another actor read it in California once, but then I thought, no, this will be very good for Michael. Michael will be hilarious in this. So Michael Tucker is going to read that tonight, and I'm very happy reading Taste.
We very quickly can take a call before the break. Bonnie in Forney. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi there. I was just going to ask a quick question about child actors doing readings. The question actually comes from my children who are homeschooled, and they're in the car with me now. And most child actors are homeschooled, too. So I just thought maybe let's address child actors and see if there's any great child actors that have done some readings for you.
We haven't done that.
On behalf of the homeschool movement.
We haven't done that yet, but perhaps we should give it a try. Thank you.
Isaiah Sheffer is with us. He is in town for an event tonight at the Dallas Theater Center at 7:30, Texas Bound from Broadway Food Fictions. That is a series that's being read for the Selected Shorts series that runs on public radio. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Isaiah Sheffer of Selected Shorts. He's in town for Texas Bound from Broadway Food Fictions. That is a Selected Shorts series of reading that will take place tonight at 7:30 at the Dallas Theater Center. You can find information about that at dallasmuseumofart.org or on the Think page of kera.org. We will hear now another clip from the show. This one is a story called Gleason by Louise Erdrich, which was read a couple of weeks ago on the show by Robert Sean Leonard.
John Stragg opened his front door wide, and there was Gleason, his girlfriend Jade's little brother. The boy stood frail and skinny in the snow with a sad look on his face and a gun in his hand. As the president of the New Otto Bank of New Otto, North Dakota, Stragg had trained his employees to stay relaxed in situations like this. Small town banks were vulnerable. Stragg had actually been held up twice. One of the robbers had even been a methamphetamine addict. He did not flinch now. "What can I do for you?" he said to Gleason. His voice was loud and calm. His wife, Carmen, was reading in the living room. "You can come with me, Mr. Stragg," Gleason said, leading slightly to the left with the barrel of the gun. Behind him, at the curb, a low-slung Oldsmobile idled. Stragg could see no one else in it. Gleason was just 19 years old, and Stragg now wished that he had joined the army, as Jade had said he was threatening to do. Except that if he had...
That was a little snippet of Gleason by Louise Erdrich, read by Robert Sean Leonard on Selected Shorts a couple of weeks ago. My guest is Isaiah Sheffer, who is the founder and artistic director of Symphony Space in New York, which produces Selected Shorts. you know, listening to that, the cadence of Leonard's voice is so perfect for the language there.
He's a wonderful actor, and I would entrust him with the most difficult stories. Robert Sean and I have a comedy act going in that he's very much a New York actor, always was. He was on Broadway and all sorts of things. His resume of Broadway and off-Broadway is lengthy. And when I needed him to read a story and he could get up to Symphony Space on a Wednesday night, done and done. And then he got this TV series that brought him out to California. And so we'd ask him about New York dates and he said, no, I'm sorry, I'm here in L.A. doing my series. And then we thought, well, let's see, May 2nd, 3rd, 4th, we're going to be in Los Angeles. I'll call Robert Sean and say, can you read at the Getty Museum since you're there? Well, that's just the week that he's coming east to promote the series. And back and forth, this has been going on now for a year or two. He did read that Gleason, but since then we've talked several times when just we're at opposite coasts from each other. But I would go a long way to have him read. He is really one of the best. I shouldn't say that publicly because all the other actors will feel bad, but maybe they're not listening. There are a few who are really very, very skilled actors at doing all kinds of things, and they've been regulars on our series. We try having a balance between regulars like Stephen Lang or Fritz Weaver or Christina Pickles or Marion Seldes, who are just superb, and an admixture of new names and new faces and new voices to keep the series fresh, as they say. And we're constantly looking for new actors who will work well with a story. I would like to say a word about my two colleagues tonight. Jill Eikenberry and Michael Tucker are perhaps best known to people for their years together. They're a husband and wife, of course, but they were not... Well, were they husband and wife on L.A. Law? But they starred in L.A. Law and won an astounding number of Emmy Awards and over the years. And but they are also terrific comic actors, more than L.A. Law gave them a chance to express all the time. And I think in reading the Dorothy Parker story, this droll thing of a woman who is stuck at a dinner party with this person on the left whom she'd like to incinerate and who asks her questions about cucumbers and salad when a very attractive man is on her right and she'd like to be talking to him, but all she gets to see is his right shoulder. But she fantasizes about what she would say to him if he would only turn this way. She's a terrific comic actress, and I think from the two of them we'll have a lot of laughs tonight.
I was reading just a little bit of that story before I came and sat down in here with you, and it seems that Dorothy Parker is one of those writers who writes for the ear.
Yes.
Do you have the sense that the best writers are always the ones who have it out loud in their studio before they actually put it on the page?
I don't know how they work, but she certainly writes conversation and the rhythms of conversation, and in this case, non-conversation, because she can't get a rise out of this jerk on her left who she's condemned to be having dinner with, and we're only up to the soup and it's going to be a long, long evening. And she suffers with that. But I guess I don't really know the answer to your question. If you take a writer like, very different from Dorothy Parker, like Raymond Carver, the spare, fine, sculptured texts of his stories where just a word or a phrase can contain so much. It isn't the kind of repartee that you find in the Dorothy Parker story, but it's certainly well-imagined conversation, well-imagined silences too, which is why, going back to what I was talking about earlier, I like to encourage actors to let the silences happen. When somebody's asked a question and the other person doesn't really answer, that says a lot. And we try to get that into the readings.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Isaiah Scheffer is here. Let's go to Zach in Fort Worth. Hi, Zach.
Hi. I had a question about kind of story selection and
yes.
How often you will go through and choose, like, sci-fi or noir, certain genre fictions, as opposed to, quote, literary fiction?
Well, the answer is we conceive literary as very broadly, including a lot of sci-fi that qualifies as literature as much as anything else. If we have an idea about doing a program with a particular style, for example, coming up next week is an example of what you're asking of. Symphony Space as an entire institution is doing something in the month of February called the 1939 Project. We're talking about the year 1939 as a pivotal transitional year in American history and politics and culture. And so we're doing movies and stories and dance and music of many different kinds from that year, ranging from Gone with the Wind to The Women to music of Charles Ives and Aaron Copland. But this Wednesday night at Selected Shorts, coming up on, next Wednesday night, the 18th, we're doing a program called Pulp Fiction Stories from Black Mask Magazine. Black Mask Magazine published a lot of hard-boiled noir detective stories, and James Naughton is going to read one, and Ted Marcoux is going to read another. And there we said, this is going to be that kind of genre evening. In the past, we've have at sometimes done, we didn't exactly call them science fiction stories, but we did a program in California that was about journeys into the unexpected that really did include stories that I think could be classified as science fiction. If we build programs around themes, then we start looking. Otherwise, we look very broadly. We look for stories that delight us.
Do you have to be conscious of sort of the mood? If you build something very dramatic, do you want to lighten the mood, or do you want to sort of keep the hour all continuous?
Well, that's interesting. That the next step, in addition to choosing actors and choosing stories, is arranging menus. An evening at Symphony Space or an evening like tonight at the Texas Theater Center can have a theme, but even within that theme, there's got to be an appetizer tonight and a main dish. And in an evening at Selected Shorts at Symphony Space, there may not be a specific theme. Or, for example, last Wednesday we did a program of three stories written by three young American writers who are associated with a certain hangout on Amsterdam Avenue near Columbia University. There's the legendary, or if it's not legendary, it's getting to be legendary, Hungarian pastry shop. And these were three stories that did not have anything to do with Hungary or pastry, but three students, former students or teachers, connected with the Columbia or the Hunter College graduate programs in writing. And that was the theme. It was that crowd. And so a lot of young writing students from all around came to that evening to hear what the young contemporary writers were doing. But the stories had to be arranged in a way that had a kind of funny opening. You might call it the appetizer, though the author might not be pleased to know that her story was an appetizer. And then a more serious story, and then after intermission, a main dish. And there are some stories that you know you can't follow them with something else. That has to be the final story of the evening. And because it has that weight or that punch, it's a matter of feel, just as it would be in arranging a menu.
Now, authors, contemporary and otherwise, don't necessarily use language that is approved by the FCC. How do you handle that?
Oh, we handle it unsatisfactorily to me. At Symphony Space or in live performances, we edit nothing. We do what the authors have written. When it comes to putting it on the air, we have tried to grapple with the problem, and it's a very difficult one, of controlling language so as not to offend and not to get stations into trouble with regulatory agencies. And so we do it ourselves. We do the, not bleeping out because the beeps are too intrusive, but the dropping out of certain words. But we get mail that is about 50-50. Half of the people say, thank you so much for cleaning up that story so that my kids can listen to it in the car. And the other half of the mail says, you people are wimps. You call yourself promoters of literature. You're just editing and censoring what authors, American and non-American, young and old, have written. Now, if we're doing a Tim O'Brien story about Marines in Vietnam, you can't do that without certain words that are prohibited being laced through the language. This is, after all, a Marine wounded in a Vietnamese jungle. So what do? Do you not do the story? Do you do it and broadcast a series of a lot of bleeps? We haven't, to my mind, found the right answer. We do it, and I'm sorry we do it, but I'm glad if it makes some people more comfortable. But I'm sorry we do it.
So you're sort of on both sides of the question yourself.
Well, I'm tormented by the fact that we have to do what... when I listen to some programs on cable TV, I won't mention any names like Deadwood or The Sopranos, and listen to the language on that. I think they're saying those words, and we can't have a Marine in Vietnam say, bleep. It seems to me unfair, in far as the great American listening public, that what you can do in that realm and what you mustn't do for fear of... we've had station directors of public radio stations say to us, we love your show, but please be careful about language things because we don't want to have heavy fines imposed by the FCC and we don't want to get into trouble and we don't want our listeners objecting.
Are we too prude in this country about language? Or do we pretend to be too prude?
I think there's a lot of pretense about it. If you listen to language in the street, do you think that's the way Americans are talking? Well, why can't you have it in your drama? You do. Why can't you have it in your literature? You do. And why can't you broadcast that on public radio? Well, I don't know. We do an annual event called Bloomsday on Broadway every June 16th for the last 28 years, in which frequently we have a wonderful actress reading the complete monologue of Molly Bloom for 3 hours, complete with every word that was certified by a United States Court of Appeals judge as to be not obscene. But we do it after 10 p.m., which is supposed to be okay, and nobody's ever threatened us or the radio stations that have broadcast us with prosecution because of that. But it's an awkward subject that nobody is entirely happy with. If we had a bad word earlier in a Bloomsday broadcast before 10 p.m., the thought is we might have trouble by the broadcasting station.
Isaiah Sheffer is founder and artistic director of Symphony Space in New York. He's in town for Texas Bound from Broadway, Food Fictions. It is the 18th annual performance in Dallas of Selected Shorts, the public radio series hosted by Isaiah Sheffer. You can listen to that show on Saturday evenings at 7 on KERA. The reading takes place tonight at 7:30 at the Dallas Theater Center. Isaiah, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much. I'll see you, folks.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.